It's the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast. Coming in 3, 2, 1.
You are listening to the NASA Lunar Science Institute podcast, which highlights the latest news and information of the Moon, on the Moon, and from the Moon. It's produced by the NASA Lunar Science Institute at the Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California.
It was a surprise gift from the sky. Hi, this is Nancy Atkinson for the NASA Lunar Science Institute. On April 22, 2012, in the early morning hours over the Sierra foothills of California, a meteor flashed through the daytime skies and exploded, causing quite a bit of excitement. The aftermath brought a unique search for meteorites. With us to tell us more is Greg Schmidt, who is the Deputy Director of NLSI. Hi, Greg, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nancy. Happy to be here.
Can you tell us a little about what happened on April 22nd and kind of the excitement that took place out in California?
Yeah, you bet. Well, first of all, this was quite a large bolide, which is the larger form of meteors that we see. There was an explosion, as you say, in the early morning hours of Sunday, April 22nd. This explosion was heard for many tens of miles away. It was fairly large, and from all the data that we've collected so far, this is still a little bit of a guess, but we're thinking that the object that came into Earth's atmosphere was roughly the size of a minivan, weighing several tons. So this was a large object. These sorts of things enter the atmosphere perhaps every year or so, maybe a little bit more often. But the thing about this one is it entered over a moderately populated area, was heard by a lot of people, and had a fairly well-defined trajectory that allowed us to embark on a pretty exciting meteorite search.
Yes, and you and several people from the NASA Lunar Science Institute and NASA Ames used a very unique tool to search for meteorites. Could you tell us about that?
We did indeed. And so let me give you just a little bit of background on this. So when the meteor exploded, it was going at a relatively shallow angle with respect to the Earth's surface. And after some analysis, what we and the lead of this effort, Dr. Peter Janiskins of the SETI Institute, thought was that the smaller fragments that resulted from the explosion would fall faster because they're smaller, they weigh less, and they're slowed down by the atmosphere more quickly. Whereas any larger fragments that resulted would tend to go a little bit farther down the trail. And so that was the objective of this very unique search. What we decided to do is use a Zeppelin, the only operational Zeppelin in the United States right now. It's run by a company called Airship Ventures. It's mostly used for tourist flights, but it's pretty uniquely qualified to do a search of the kind that we were interested in. What we wanted to do is find the big chunks, the kind that that would give us scientific information for decades to come. And this particular Zeppelin flies very low. It flies very slowly. It can essentially just stop over any particular area. It's equipped with a very high resolution camera. And actually on board, you can see pretty small objects, relatively speaking. So we thought that this would be the best kind of vantage point from which we could go up and down the path to try to find something.
All right. That gives you kind of a bird's eye view, I guess.
It sure does.
Were you successful? Were you able to find anything using the airship?
Well, we have some preliminary sightings that we've made The thing is, with this meteor, most of the land under the path where all these fragments fell is owned by private property owners, and we of course have to respect their land rights and everything, and request permission to go on their land. The small number of sightings that we've been able to follow up on so far have turned out not to be meteors, and actually have turned out to be black objects of various forms. We've followed up on about 30% or so of the sightings. The intention is to follow up on the rest in the next month or so. We're excited by the potential that even one of these might be an object that would be perhaps hundreds of grams, maybe even in the kilogram range. And so the way I think about it is the chance of finding something, it's hard to even estimate what that would be, but the scientific value was so high that we had to take the chance.
Right. And I know that Dr. Jenniskens did find some meteorite pieces, and also there was at least one family that found some on their land and donated it to NASA. What has been some of the initial findings or first looks at what kind of meteorites these are?
Yeah, well, what we have found so far is very preliminary, but this meteorite seems to be a fairly unique kind of carbonaceous chondrite. And carbonaceous chondrites are a rare kind of meteorite. They occur in less than 1% of the meteorite falls. But the interesting thing about them is they could represent some of the original material in the solar system that might have given rise to life when that material fell on Earth. So we're very excited by the potential for long-term study of these and what they say about the early solar system. This is a remnant of the formation of the solar system that has been in its own independent orbit around the sun for quite literally billions of years. So it's some pristine material that analysis could reveal some very interesting things. That analysis has only just begun, actually. We have some analysis that's ongoing on one of the pieces that was very kindly loaned to us by one of the landowners who found a piece on his land. And this particular piece is in Italy right now undergoing gamma ray spectroscopy, taking a look at all the different isotopes that, and one of the things that's important to do with this is to do this this kind of an analysis fairly quickly, because these isotopes decay fairly quickly. And if we do it quick enough, we can learn a lot about the state of the parent body prior to its entry into the atmosphere.
Okay. Going back for a minute to the using the airship to search for this, could you talk about how many scientists were on board or participants were on board? And I believe this was the first time that an airship was ever used to search for meteorites. So would you recommend it to be used for future searches?
I would absolutely recommend it without qualification. It was a very, very useful tool to be able to have scientists on board to be able to guide the airship to new locations. Just proved immensely valuable. There were about five scientists on board this mission. I was on the initial calibration phase, and then gave up my seat to actual practicing meteorite scientists. So for the mission, I exchanged places with them when we got up to Sacramento. We started off from the base of Airship Ventures at Moffett Field, where we, the NASA Lunar Science Institute, are also located.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about the findings of the meteorite specialists looking at this meteorite, which is called the Sutter's Mill meteorites, because it fell close to where the gold was found back in the 1800s. So this is extremely interesting and an interesting project for NLSI to be involved with.
It sure is, Nancy. We are immensely excited by this and the lessons that it might teach us. And all indications are that this was a very, very special meteorite fall. And I find that the coincidence that it fell right over Sutter's Mill, which being a native Californian is kind of a special place to me, it was a very interesting coincidence. And I think that the gold, the scientific gold that we're going to be obtaining from this meteorite in years hence is going to be worth a whole lot more than the real gold was.
Exactly. Well, Greg Schmidt, thank you very much for joining us today to tell us more about the very unique meteorite hunt that you were part of.
Thanks so much, Nancy. Happy to talk with you.
To find out more about this topic, visit our website at www.lunarscience.nasa.gov. Any opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the opinion of NASA or the NASA Lunar Science Institute. This podcast is produced for educational and information purposes only. On behalf of the NASA Lunar Science Institute, thanks for listening.
This episode of 365 Days of Astronomy is sponsored by iTelescope.net, expanding your horizons in astronomy today. The premier on-demand telescope network at dark sky sites in Spain, New Mexico, and Siding Spring, Australia.
You are listening to the IYA 365 Days of Astronomy podcast.
The 365 Days of Astronomy podcast is produced by Astrosphere New Media Association. Audio post-production by Preston Gibson. Bandwidth donated by Libsyn.com and Wizard Media. Web design by Clockwork Active Media Systems. You may reproduce and distribute this audio for non-commercial purposes. Please consider supporting the podcast with a few dollars or euros. Visit us on the web at 365daysofastronomy.org or email us at info@365daysofastronomy.org. Until tomorrow, goodbye.